Why do you want to talk to me, Sam?
I don't want to be hurt.
Why is he calling?
I don't want to go to the gas chamber.
You won't get hurt if you talk to me.
You're not going to the gas chamber.
I wouldn't think they would ask for capital
punishment. We should ask the district attorney. Do you want me to do that, Sam? Do you want me to talk to the district attorney?
Well, what was that, Sam?
I did not say anything.
We heard a scream.
That was my headache.
You sound like you're in a great deal of pain.
My head aches. I'm so sick. Oh, I'm going to kill them.
I'm going to kill those kids.
Fantastic.
So hi and welcome to the Unnamed Movie Podcast. This is Andrew.
And this is Douglas.
Yeah, that silence is Damien's absence. I think he felt he needed a week off after being alone with me last week. But whatever. this week we have with us Ryan Helms from A Life in Equinox, which you can find at univarn.blogspot.com. How are you doing tonight, Ryan?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm surviving, you know. I'm trying to move day to day here.
Singing a lot of disco tunes?
Yeah. I am into disco nowadays. It is really interesting, except when I really just want to talk about movies, because Douglas looks bored already. Douglas, more beer.
Okay, that's a solution to my problem.
And I guess we can start off by talking about what we've been watching. Ryan, what have you been watching this week?
Beyond the movie we're actually talking about later on tonight, the only thing I've been doing is going back through the Harry Potter films. No idea why. I mean, not like anything else is happening that could possibly lead me to want to do something like that.
We have no clue why you're watching those movies.
No, it's just one of those freak things, you know. It's one of those days I go, you know, it seems like a Harry Potter day.
Can I ask you, which one of the Harry Potter films is your favorite?
I've actually always been a big fan of Goblet of Fire. And I know that's not too much controversial, but it's the one nobody seems to pick but me.
That's the one with the dragon. Ryan, you're an asshole. I hate that movie.
And of course, not counting 1 and 2, because those are obvious scapegoats, what's your least favorite?
Goblet of Fire. Actually, no, you know what my least favorite is. That last god-awful thing.
I don't know, it's unfair.
It's unfair because I actually like the second one, which makes everyone kind of have a head explosion when they talk to me about Harry Potter. But I would say the next worst one after that for me would probably be, and everyone hates this when I say it, Order of the Phoenix. It's just, I don't know what it was about that movie. I just sat there the whole time going, how can you fly something you can't see? Would you not fall off?
Okay, so but I have just one quick question, and that question is, how is it that The Deathly Hallows is better than any other Harry Potter movie?
Sexy CGI action. Duh.
I like people with smart answers.
Okay.
Wow.
I kind of feel with Deathly Hallows like a mother having to protect a child, even though I have no real relation to it, because everyone just sort of went, I can't believe this movie is only half a movie. What did you expect?
That's totally Douglas's problem. He just doesn't like the fact that it's half a movie.
No, you know what? My problem is not that it's half a movie. Lord of the Rings is a half a movie. Not that it's
a third of a movie.
No, it's not that there's not enough Reese fans, which, by the way, there isn't. But it's the fact that this is not a movie. No matter whether it's supposed to be a half a movie or not, you need to come out of the thing feeling like you were entertained. And that just didn't happen with this movie. It was 5 hours of film that could have been cut short to a half an hour, which thereby would give them the rest of the movie time to finish the movie. So I don't get that.
See, I actually think they should have just gone full David Lean and just gone like a four-hour epic. They could have brought in Peter O'Toole just to finish the effect.
Yeah, I would have been completely okay with that.
But I think one of the reasons they did do it the way they did it was they wanted to stay true to the story, which I don't understand because they haven't been doing it that much all along. Why they suddenly feel the need to, you know, really stick with the book. But, and because of that, the book was very wordy.
Yeah, it was.
And I don't mean to say, like, it was, you know, there was a lot of words in it. Obviously, it's a book. And, but it just, there was a lot of explanation about the explanation that was going to become another explanation.
No, and...
And the movie tried to compact that into something they can show, and it's hard.
This is true, and she tended to do that exponentially more as the number of the book increased.
I always found that weird watching you guys read the books where everyone would come out and you'd just get a little bit thicker as you move along.
But listen, I love that shit. Love those books.
Well, I mean, it can't have been any worse than me having read the Game of Thrones books last summer.
Oh, I think I need
Song
to do that
of Ice and Fire. That third book took me forever to finish, like 1,000 pages long.
I don't want to spoil TV. It's going to be on TV and it's going to be awesome. I don't want to ruin that for myself.
Whatever, dude.
So, is there anything particular that went on during this Harry Potter-a-thon for you?
Not especially. I mean, so far I've only watched the first couple and I'm about to start the third tomorrow, but I don't know. I the more I watch them, the more I kind of get caught between... I always had a bit of a grudge when the Harry Potter films first came out because I was a Lord of the Rings kid. My sister was the Harry Potter girl. And so there was that sort of family clash because they both came out in, I think, 2001, Fellowship of the Ring and Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah, they did.
And so there was sort of that, I don't want to say animosity, but that sort of tension.
Only
we know
one
which one's better.
Supreme.
Come on.
Were you pissed that there were more Harry Potter books for there to be more movies, and you know, you get like eventually
hey,
people
but no,
stop
if you,
talking?
If you think about it, if you think about it, Lord of the Rings has lasted longer because The Hobbit hasn't come out yet, and those are going to be two movies.
I am actually very worried about The Hobbit.
Really? I just watched.
I'm worried he's trying to stretch butter over a thin amount of butter over a long piece of bread.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That book is
nice,
very thin.
Nice Lord of Rings reference right there.
There you go. It's
not a reference. It's the same.
Well, it was.
I had to sneak it in as best as I could, but it was. The book. What I liked about The Hobbit as a kid was that it was a very good book for if you're like, you know, 6 to 10 years old, because it's quick, it's witty, and it's over. and it's not something that's really cumbersome. There's not a lot of intricate plot details, and so I don't know how he's going to stretch it in the two movies unless he really pads on the drama.
Well, you never know. I've actually read The Hobbit, and I remember enjoying it. But I don't think I've ever read the Lord of the Rings books,
I don't know
how to compare like my expectations of films and stuff with that.
Well, I have always been... I grew up watching The Hobbit animated.
Oh, I used to love that cartoon. I used to watch.
There was a point in my life where I could pretty much hum the beat to every single musical tune in that film. I was obsessed with it as a kid.
Yeah.
And I have such a dead set picture of the voice actors in that. It's going to be tough for me to watch The Hobbit and not think... Because the Lord of the Rings animated film, I think everyone immediately forgot as quick as possible after. But the Hobbit one is pretty darn good.
I actually don't think I ever watched the Lord of the Rings one. I only saw The Hobbit.
You saved yourself about a couple hours of your time.
I saw the Lord of the Rings one like later in life. Like, a friend of mine who was a big Lord of the Rings fan got the DVDs for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings animated films, and I'm like, I remember The Hobbit, but I don't remember Lord of the Rings, and he made me sit down and watch the whole thing, and it was kind of bad. It was crazy how much more in The Lord of the Rings animated film that I realized how gay the Sam and Frodo relationship is.
Even if they were gay, I don't think it really matters.
I know, but you know, it's just little things you notice. But anyways, Douglas, what have you been watching?
What have I been watching? Well, as I give myself time to load up my notes with what I have been watching, I will say that this week first of all, it's been 2 weeks, really, because I missed out last week's episode. But it's been a very TV-filled couple of
weeks.
You mean
the usual stuff.
Exactly. But no, I actually so the last episode I was on, I started talking about the show called White Collar.
Yeah.
I had watched the first episode, thought it was really good, and now 2 weeks later, I have officially caught up with the show, so I'm now at season 3, episode 5. This show is pretty awesome. It's very much popcorn rubbish, but you know, you have to have a little bit of popcorn in your life. In that kind of frame of mind, I went looking for more USA shows and found another one called Suits that just started, and that show is kind of awesome as well. So it's been a very, not only TV-filled couple of weeks, but a very USA TV-filled couple of weeks. And that's essentially all that I've been watching. Quick, short, to the point.
To the point.
How about you?
I have been spending my time with a lot of films in the last week. A few that I really want to mention. One is Take Me Home Tonight, which I know you and Damien have mentioned in passing, and you guys don't seem too happy with the movie.
It's so much potential. So much potential.
Potential, i.e. it was an 80s movie, and Douglas was looking forward to 80s movies.
Damn right, I love 80s movies, especially the ones where it's like one crazy night. Love it.
I personally enjoyed the film. I thought it was really good. It wasn't the greatest movie you're ever going to see. It's not groundbreaking or anything, but, I mean, everything worked. Topher Grace was good, Anna Faris was fine, and Dan Fogler's crazed, drug-induced evening was quite enjoyable to me. I don't know what there was to complain about the movie. It's exactly what it promised to be in my eyes. No. Anyways, I'll move on. I also saw Crimes and Misdemeanors, the Woody Allen film starring Martin Landau, and I think that it's a really interesting film because while it kind of sticks to the Woody Allen 80s themes that he usually goes through with Annie Hall and Manhattan, I think those are in the late 70s, but yeah, whatever, where it's the ensemble romantic comedy awkwardness, this one kind of has, even though throughout all of his films it talks about it, but this film I think brings the religious aspect a bit higher than all of his other films, and it's a really interesting take on murder and relationships and what you do for love. And while I wouldn't call it my favorite Woody Allen film, I think it's really slightly different from the usual, which is always good.
When did this one come out?
This one was in 89.
Alright, fair enough.
Also, two more movies I want to talk about. I saw Barry's Version, the film with Paul Giamatti. Barney's Version. I have only had...
Get your purple dinosaur references correct, or I'll have to kick you off the show.
Barney's Version. And it's actually a really good movie. Giamatti is fantastic, and it's one of those great life stories where he's telling the story of his love life throughout, from his youth all the way up through his three marriages, and it centers around him thinking back to this as an old man. And I mean, it wouldn't hit anyone's top 10 list, but at the same time, it's, you'd be wrong to not consider Giamatti one of the best performances of last year. He did win a Golden Globe for the performance, but that's neither here nor there, honestly. It's it's a really good movie. And the last movie I really want to talk about is Marie Antoinette. It's the only Sofia Coppola movie, or as we like to call her nicely on this podcast, Soko, film that I haven't seen yet.
That's not true. Have you watched Lick the Star?
Lick the Star isn't a movie, is it?
I haven't watched it either. I just, you know, have it to watch.
You have it to watch. I'm sure that's not a real movie.
Lick the Star is a movie done by Soko, okay?
The movie is actually really good. It's very different from all of her other films, namely Lost in Translation and Somewhere.
Stop. What?
What?
First of all, those aren't her other films. But what? It's different? How so?
It's not...
Because it's not in a hotel? Is that it?
It's kind of in a hotel. It's in a big castle. Okay. Jason Schwartzman is
well,
the
then
king.
That's not your argument. What's the next one? Come on.
It doesn't feel as mundane as the rest of her films. It feels like things actually happen throughout this movie. And it's kind of what Damon was arguing about when he was ranting on about Soko and how shitty how much he hated Somewhere. Right? The movie actually has a plot and the characters move along throughout it. Even though you kind of have the historical backdrop to fall on every time that it slows down.
I was about to say, it's kind of hard to not have a story when you're talking about history.
But it's a really good film, and I really like that it kind of stands out from all the other period pieces you'll watch, mainly because not only her style, but the way that she puts together certain scenes, and especially the soundtrack she puts to it. Who else would put I Want Candy in a period piece in the soundtrack? And it's kind of great.
Who was it that did this soundtrack?
I don't think there was anyone specific who did it, but there's songs from all sorts of bands and stuff that you would love.
I think there was a big band that did a lot of the music from the soundtrack.
But anyways, that's really all I want to talk about right now. I need more beer.
There are six of them here. I'm sure you can find one.
I'm surprised they're not colder.
Whatever, dude.
Ryan is laughing at home. He's like, where's my beer?
I'm actually just sitting here trying to think. Sofia Coppola.
What's your
Wouldn't it be awesome if she did a Godfather Part 3? Part
it,
2.
It probably would be, yeah.
What do you think of Soko?
I think very little.
Oh,
her.
Wow.
Not in terms of her movies. I just don't think about her.
Oh.
Like, I watched Lost in Translation. The movie was over. I turned it off. I didn't really bother thinking about it much until later on when everyone kept telling me how much they thought about the movie. And I was like, oh, okay.
So I think you fall into the Damien realm of Soko.
No, I think
I don't really rant or hate her movies. It was just
the
credits.
The way you sound about it is that you're just unaffected by what really annoys Damien about the movies. Is that he feels nothing ever really happens and it's so mundane and boring and stretched out, and you're just like, okay, I guess that's the movie. I'm going to go over there now. Something's happening
I've seen a lot of movies where nothing happens, and so it's not a big stretch to me to watch a movie and go, wow, nothing really happened there. Apparently he whispered something in her ear, which has caused masses of people to have spasms on the internet.
I rewatched Lost in Translation the other day. I love that movie so much.
My favorite part about the movie was when Giovanni Ribisi showed up, and then when he left, I was like, what the fuck?
I love Ribisi. That guy's amazing.
That was the highlight of the film for me, and he was in there like 5 minutes.
I know, right?
I love this moment when they go out to lunch, and he's just sitting there, and she's mad at him because she found out he banged the singing girl from the bar, and he's just like, come on, man. Was there no one else to lavish you with attention? And I find that so funny. I don't know why.
I thought Bill Murray was really good in like the first 30 minutes, and then everything once Scarlett Johansson to me in that movie was really the anti-entertainment to Bill Murray's entertainment, which is why I think I kind of left indifferent.
Because
Bill Murray would come and say, "Look, I'm being entertaining and interesting," and Scarlett Johansson would come in and go,
"Have you seen that article? I can't remember where it was posted on our site. It was a long time ago, where Sofia Coppola revealed, and I'm sure other people have translated it for everyone, but basically revealed the English version of the script for this scene with the Santori Time ad, where the director is going on, and he's just like, really? I'm sure there's more to that. And it's a really interesting scene if you read out the dialogue, because it makes absolutely no sense, because she wrote it in English of this guy saying something that he's never going to understand, and I found it funny when I read through it. I remember that. I should probably find that article. Trailers, there really wasn't much interesting on the net this week. I mean, unless you really like Adam Sandler movies. But the full trailer for The Adventures of Tintin came out, which is the Christmas release. The big Christmas release with Steven Spielberg directing and a lot of people voice acting and motion capturing.
That model ship conceals a clue to one of the greatest treasures in all history. Good boy, Snowy. Are you going to take charge of this evidence?
Never fear, Tintin. The evidence is safe with us.
Thompson? Where are you?
Oh, well, I'm already downstairs. Do try to keep up.
He has no idea what's coming.
You know the value of that scroll.
I will find it, with or without your help.
Thanks, Tintin, by the way.
Haddock. Archibald Haddock.
Douglas, what did you think of this trailer?
I've seen what people have said about this trailer. I've been on the Twitters, I've been on the Facebooks, I've been on the Google Pluses. Yeah, that's right, I got an early invite. Everybody seems to love this trailer. Everybody says, oh, Steven Spielberg is back. He's been gone for so long. What have those guys been smoking? Which trailer did they watch? And please show me the one that they did, because I did not see it clearly. This trailer was okay. There was a bunch of computer graphics in it. There was a dog doing silly things. There were criminals. And there was a hero with a gun that got shot at. If that translates into a good trailer, I don't know. This movie just doesn't have the promise that everybody seems to see in it. At least I don't see that kind of promise. I'm not saying that it's going to be a bad movie. On the contrary, I really want to watch it. And I actually haven't lost as much faith in Spielberg as apparently so many people have.
Did you see the trailer for War Horse?
No,
is his other movie
I haven't seen. I haven't seen War Horse yet, but I've heard the stories. You know, it's like the ghost stories. To get free, whatever. This trailer just doesn't look that great. It looks like it's selling me an average movie, and I'm okay with that because I believe in Spielberg. I just don't understand people that are the opposite, that don't believe in him, but look at this trailer and think that it's wonderful. I don't get that. This trailer doesn't sell me.
Right.
Not that much.
Well, to continue on your point, one of the things I find most amusing about sort of the anti-Spielberg contingent is they really seem to try to box him into about three films that he's made, which is Minority Report, War of the Worlds, and Jurassic Park. And they try and like say these three movies represent everything Spielberg's ever done.
Wow.
And it's like, not really. I mean, he's done a lot of different movies. I'm not saying he's, you know, going to be remembered forever as the greatest director of all time or anywhere near that sort of hyperbole, but he's made a lot of movies with a lot of great range and quality. And so that's my Spielberg part. As to the trailer, it was okay. I mean, I'm not crying or jumping up with excitement, but I thought it was interesting enough.
Yeah.
I think there was a guy with a beard in it. What could you ask for?
He sets fire to a boat
for no reason. Come on. Other than he's crazy, it seems.
Probably. The best part about that is he actually managed to get firewood in the middle of the ocean. The guy's obviously a wizard. This movie's gonna be amazing.
Hey, how else are you gonna like roast marshmallows in the middle of the sea? It doesn't roast itself. Come on.
I'm sure he can't live with
and better yet, marshmallows. He created a firewood in a boat in the middle of the ocean. And made it blow up.
Have you guys actually watched this show, Tintin, ever? I know you might, Douglas, you definitely
have. Probably have, I don't remember.
I used to watch it a lot.
I don't remember it.
Ryan,
I have not. Though I've read about a million comments of people telling me that how amazing it was. I was like, okay.
You know what I remember watching a lot, actually? Mm-hmm. That seems similar to this. But is not at all. It's Paddington Bear.
I may have forgotten that.
Good, continue so that I don't have to explain that.
I really remember enjoying Tintin as a child, but it's one of those things where I'm afraid to go back, you know? You're afraid that you'll go back and you'll realize how infantile and stupid that really is. But when I watch his trailer, I'm
what
like...
What are you talking about? Jason the Wheel Warriors is the greatest cartoon ever.
I always stick with Fraggle Rock because you can never go wrong with Fraggle Rock.
I love Fraggle Rock.
16, 10, 9, 32 in stoned. It's perfect at any age.
Stoned.
Well, you can't watch Fraggle Rock in your 20s and 30s and be perfectly level, I don't think.
It's not
I mean, that would really
Fraggle
fuck
Rock,
with your mind.
Right? It's not for Fraggle Rock. But this trailer, I really like it, but I think I like it for the wrong reasons. In that, if I forget all the nostalgia of how much I enjoyed the cartoon as a child, and I don't think about, I'm looking forward to fantastic CG stories, it looks like all of the elements come together in the trailer and looks like a stock Spielberg trailer. It looks like...
By the way, speaking of stock Spielberg, I'd just like to posit something. No, actually, this goes against my argument. Never mind. Continue.
Like, I'd imagine that if I Google searched the Raiders of the Lost Ark trailer and sat down and watched that, it would look really close, style-wise and general structure to this trailer.
You kind of got to think about the original Spielberg trailers for films like Late Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of became the foundation among which the modern action trailers are built. So, in essence, all those big blockbuster trailers are kind of just spins on those old 70s and 80s Spielberg and Lucas trailers.
That probably is very true.
I mean, you can boil down most trailers into like maybe five parts. They all start with some slow motion shot of some scenery with a guy doing a narration, then a series of quick cuts of people doing things, then someone saying something, then more quick cuts, and then someone trying to be funny. And if you've made a trailer in the last year, you probably put a loud thumping sound over and over again just so people can maybe associate it with Inception. But I actually remember that thumping sound being, I think, in the Pirates of the Caribbean at the World's End trailer way back, and that really irritated me. It wasn't that sound thumping, that same bwom sound, but it was the entire trailer was just basically them running back and forth on a boat and going, dun, dun, dun. It's like the boat's upside down, dun, They're running back and forth on the boat. Done.
On a
the boat's moving. Done.
On a side note, that score for On World's End, at World's End, is a really fantastic score. Hans Zimmer, like, there's something special about him.
Yes, something very special. He just copy and paste all his song, all his scores.
He does sometimes, but honestly, I really like that World's End score. And same with Inception and The Dark Knight. And
Fair
The Rock.
Enough.
And basically, any and Rango. He did Rango's score, and that was
fantastic. Okay, let's be honest. He didn't really do Rango. He just took Ennio Morricone stuff and just copy paste Hans Zimmer.
Right, so Tintin, fantastic. I can't wait to see it. Oh, I can't wait to once again be disappointed by Steven Spielberg because I'm hyping it up.
Disappointed by Steven Spielberg.
I'm still sour for Monster House.
Did you not watch Monster House?
I'm still sour for.
Did you not watch Monster House?
No, I still haven't.
Seriously,
I haven't seen that movie.
Seriously? No, Andrew. That was, or at least as far as I know, that was the last little dabble that Spielberg went into in terms of CG, and that was the best movie ever.
Did he actually direct that movie?
I don't know, dude. His name was on it. His name was attached to it.
Yeah. His name is attached to like 90% of movies.
I don't give a shit.
Yeah, he produced it. Like, the director.
I mean, every third trailer is executive producer Steven Spielberg.
Hey, let's just say he's got a savvy investment mind.
Yeah.
But yo, Monster House was awesome. Best thing ever. Anyway, I think we had a movie to talk about.
We do have a movie to talk about. In a post-Kurosawa world where feudal Japan and samurais have always been a point of discussion, Takashi Miike decides to finally do a film. I mean, I've seen a few of his movies, but I've never seen him go to this era in Japan's history. He finally decides to do a film where the samurais who are whittling away in this world are finally standing up against the government and people in higher positions trying to ruin the world that they fought so hard for. Miike doesn't necessarily ask a question in his film as much as he decides to give us a film that sets up an action garrison that, while unoriginal, still I feel affects something particularly special. The question that I want to ask you guys, and especially Ryan, because I know that he has a particular attachment to Japanese cinema. Does this warrant an entry into the library of Japanese cinema, or is it just a riff on something that we've seen 5 billion times before and we prefer to forget? Ryan?
Well, I mean, obviously it deserves an entry. I mean, Takashi Miike is one of the more prolific directors of the modern Japanese cinema.
But is prolific really necessarily a good thing? Prolific is
that,
just...
That is a good question, and I think, as a visual component, 13 Assassins minus crazy horrible CGI cows on fire
All right, that was bad. That was really bad.
That was horrible.
Someone should have made the call on that one. Well, let's pass on this one. We'll just have them run away from nothing. It's better this way. But beyond that, I think he really made a visually exciting film to watch. I wish there was actually some writing involved.
Douglas is just jumping in joy right now.
Because the problem is you have the opening scene, which is basically shoving down your throat. This guy is really bad. Take it. Take it. He's horrible.
He puts the lotion in the basket.
And then you kind of have about 45 minutes of going, la 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 la. Bunch of people, I have no idea who they are, doing things that don't really matter. And then you have the finale, which involves a bunch of people, I'm vaguely sure were the good guys, killing a bunch of people I'm pretty sure were bad guys, dying. And I would have had no idea who was who, not for the fact that the good guys were wearing all black and the bad guys were wearing all white. Beyond that, I had no discernible knowledge as to what was going on. It was incredibly fun to watch. But hell if I know who was dying at any given point. It was, I can't believe they just killed Hullaba 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 who over there with the hair that's kind of is not as long as the other guy's hair thingy. And that's really my impression. I mean, it's one of those movies you, I think, is really grossing when you're in it. Then the second the credits go, you go, all right, so who the hell lived? Who died? Who was that one guy? I have no idea what happened. It's kind of like if Michael Bay and Quentin Tarantino made it, I guess.
Oh my goodness, that's stepping. That's stepping, honestly. Michael Bay and Tarantino.
Andrew, you will get your opportunity to rebut. However, I am happy. I am ecstatic that Ryan shares my opinion. My opinion is this movie is bad. I was very upset that you made me watch this movie. I remember we watched the trailer for this film at least 4 months ago. And I said to both Andrew and Damien, who for some sort of coincidental reason is not here today, I said to them, no, I bet you that the action in this movie is limited only to what is in the trailer. And they're like, no, have you never watched a Takashi Miike film? What? It's going to be filled with action. And so, when I finally got to watch this film, I was expecting tons of action, great stuff. And in a sense, I got it, right? Because there was, I can't argue, there was a lot of action in this movie.
The last 40 minutes was shit blowing up and people getting chopped in half.
It took a long ass time to get there.
And the best part about getting there was the fact that they managed to create such amazing explosions by for spending about 2 minutes hammering in a wooden log in the middle of the ground. That was their setup to this. It was a good device because it keeps the audience completely unaware as to what's going on. But basically, you just see them hammering like a log into the ground, and next thing you know, gigantic walls are collapsing around them, and cows are flying, and people are running away, and it's like, what the hell? They just knocked the log into the ground!
But seriously though, this movie is a lesson in extremes, both in the structure of the film and the setting that the film kind of has there. In terms of the structure, as Ryan was saying, I would actually go even further to say the first hour, or even more than the first half of the film, was not just slow, but painfully slow. There was no real momentum. You could see that the story was pushing towards, oh, we don't like this one guy, and we need to figure out how to deal with that one guy that we don't like. But I didn't need an hour to get those two sentences in my head, right? I didn't. It just doesn't work that way. Anyway, and on the flip side, the second hour, because this is like a 2 hour movie, was non-stop fighting.
It's like 2.5 hours, I think.
Whatever it was. Half one is like, I don't even know what to call it. I mean,
it wasn't really, the problem was it wasn't really set up.
Yeah, it was kind of akin to the movie that Andrew made made us watch a while back, Tree of Life, that...
I never made you watch Tree of...
Not Tree of Life, sorry, the other one.
Badlands?
No, the other one. The Pocahontas.
Oh, The New World.
The New World. Apologies, The New World. So Andrew made us watch...
I wish I had seen Tree of Life.
Andrew made us watch A New World, and while I respect Malick, that movie was horrible. And the thing that this movie shares, though it is not as blatant in this movie, is that in the Tree of Life, there were certain points that he needed in order for the movie to progress, and he had each of those points inside his movie, except it was, here is my information, now I'm going to give you about half hour of really pretty shots that serve no purpose and really don't need to be in this movie. Here's another point. I'm going to get back to that soon, but here's another, hour of rubbish. And that's really what happened in this first half. It was like, we know we need to set up the story that we're going to get into, but we're just gonna kind of drag you along this slow, I can't even call it a roller coaster. This just, it's a truck that's broken down that somebody's pushing, but they're on one leg and can't push that well. So it's there's no momentum at all in this story for the first hour. And so that's what I had to deal with this movie. However, not only that, the whole extremes sort of thing is also shown in the characters and the setting that the movie is in. I mean, in terms of the you've got the submission and you've got the aggression, and I understand this is a cultural thing for Japan, especially in the period, the historic period that we're dealing with. But it still feels a little bit weird, man. You've got the samurai, and you've got all the retainers and the servants that are so submissive, and even the, I don't even know if I should call them peasants, but the non, I guess, lords that are so submissive to the point of hurting their own selves. And then you've got this aggression from the ruling class, specifically, and I can't remember his name, is it Naragutu or something like that? The brother or the half-brother of the current shogun.
You're talking about the bad guy?
Yeah, the bad guy.
His name is Naritsugu.
Naritsugu, who is... I mean, it's not just him, but he is probably the best example of the extreme aggression that is shown by the, I suppose you could call them the ruling class. And on each side, it's almost like you've got a race, like a fight to win the race of who is the most excessive. Is the working class going to be more submissive than the ruling class is going to be aggressive? And they get to a point where it's, I don't know, each of them just go to this huge extreme. And I don't know if, I think maybe that's the main reason that I don't like this movie, that because most great films, especially ones with this kind of disparity, you have to kind of walk a line in between the two, and this does not. There is no line in between the polar opposites that it presents. It is either one or the other. And so you kind of, I mean, even for example, when the action came, I was so, I guess, worn out from the hour and a half or however long it was of talking and sitting and drinking sake and sitting and maybe a little more talking, that I was just like, yo, I can't do this anymore. But can I tell you the best part of this movie, I thought, the only good part of this movie, was in the end. And it actually had nothing to do with this movie. It was right at the end, there was It ended with a typical sort of historic movie ending where they're like, oh, I'm going to write words now to tell you what happened. And they started talking about how 14 years later, the Shogun era ended, and with that end came the beginning of the Meiji era. And immediately when I saw Meiji era, I was like, yo, that was in Rurouni Kenshin. I love Kenshin.
Why did I even really think of that?
And that was the best part, because it made me think of something good. So that's about it for me and my analysis of that movie. I did not like it. Just to make sure that if anybody was not certain what my stance was, I didn't like that movie. Andrew?
I don't know whether... because a lot of the things you mentioned, Douglas, that you didn't like about this movie, part of it had to do with Japanese culture.
Okay.
History. Hold on. No, give me a moment.
All right, okay.
Give me a moment. And part of it had to do with Japanese culture and history. And generally, I've come eventually to accept a lot of those aspects, because while it's very different from how we generally view life and society, over the years of watching Japanese films and Jap anime and all these things, I've caught on to a lot of things which in this era of Japan occurred. Why are you laughing at me now? What have I said?
No, I'm sorry. It's just that essentially what you said a while ago is like, I'm totally down with the Japanese. I understand them completely, because I watch cartoons. And that just... I'm sorry, that just cracked me up.
Imagine if Japanese just watch American films and they're like, you know what, I get it. They're fat, they eat lots of food, they talk back to their mothers.
They would be wrong.
What are you talking about? American films? We're all swimsuit models, obviously.
Oh, clearly.
I want to go to America.
Well, Paul Walker and that other one from that other movie, the abs.
With the abs, yeah. Yeah.
You know the one I'm talking about.
Oh, of course, of course. I know exactly what you're talking about. The one
I think I've seen one Paul Walker movie.
Yeah.
The other aspect that you were complaining about mostly was not so much the amount of time it spent, but the fact that it decided to actually take its time to set up the eventual...
No, I apologize. You can talk while I'm laughing. I'm not laughing at you. Well, maybe I am a little bit. But I'm not laughing to like, disrespect you. I'm laughing because...
I'm not going to perform Harikiri.
Because I've had a beer and a half, and this is some special beer, and you should know that.
I know. I'm kind of feeling it too, and I've gone like a beer and a half as well. But yeah, to deal with the time that this film took to set up the final event scene of the attack of the 13 assassins on the shogunate. Not the shogunate. The shogunate's half-brother, whatever.
Naragutsu.
Naritsugu.
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 That was probably racist. I apologize.
And his...
It's okay, we talked about Lost in Translation earlier. That sort of cancels it out.
Okay, cool.
And the truth of it, that the setup itself was really intricate. And I mean, there are films we've seen, especially reviewed on this podcast, where they have spent 3/4 of the film setting up, bringing together their team, giving you an idea of what plan they put together. I mean, one movie that in particular that I remember us talking about is Rafifi.
Which I would like to just put out there. I didn't like that much. Just saying. I know it's a classic and all, but that movie's kind of lame.
And I mean, that was in the early days of the podcast. I mean, it was insane.
By the way, I'd just like to also say that this movie did not take an hour to set up the film. This movie took about 5 minutes to set up the film and filled the rest of the hour with nothing. No, continue.
I don't want to be the interrupt again, because I know Andrew's kind of getting his point over here, but I would say the issue with the setup argument that you're making, Andrew, is from my perspective, it is kind of like Douglas is saying. It was about 5 minutes to explain what they were going to do and 10 minutes to kind of show the characters. And the rest was just sort of looping.
Yeah.
And I don't want it to sound too disparaging, because I didn't hate the movie. I thought it was okay. But I really feel as if you could fast forward to this, to when they arrive in the town where the whole, where the shit goes down, and you'd pretty much be fine.
And even then, you know what though? When you get to the town and they start fighting, and I'm sorry, I'm just like Ran, I'm horrible and I'm taking away from your thunder, but
I'll forget my point soon enough, don't
sweet.
Worry.
Sweet! But did I really need to see an hour of fighting? Because I'm not averse to like awesome action and stuff, and some of the sequences were really well done. And actually, you know, I should have really said that you can bring out the list on this movie, because really, you can.
I should probably put this on the wall.
Exactly. There's nothing wrong with the technical specs of this film. But I think both in the setup and in the action piece of it, there was a lot that was unnecessary. I don't need to see an hour of fighting when all you're doing is fighting in order to get to the top guy. And maybe I'm being a little bit too... maybe I'm getting a little bit too...
Gosh, you don't understand.
Don't on this film. But I think that... You know what? Alright, let me say it a little bit better. The last hour of this movie would have... It could have worked, even as it is. Even though I'm having problems with the amount of fighting and kind of just whatever that he has out there. It could have worked if the setup was better. And that was the movie. If the movie was this fight, then I think that would have worked much better.
All right, I'm going to ask you a question,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's going to come off as asking you whether you are a racist or not, but
wow.
I'm going to ask you
wow.
to be slightly honest about this. All right,
come on,
right?
Go ahead. Go for the jugular.
Right? Did you know or remember who was who, as in the group of assassins, when it came to the final fight scene?
I'm gonna tell you no, but I will preface this by saying, first of all, I remember two people. I remembered the main character, which was the big guy, and the leader. I can't remember his name right now, and don't
Shin
you dare tell me the... Yes, Shin Zaimon, that's right.
I think that's how you...
yeah, and I remembered his nephew, who was... Well,
Shinroku.
His nephew.
Is it Shinroku or Shinroku?
I can't remember. So I remember those two. Those two, I guess, maybe the film spent a little bit of time on. But the rest of them I didn't really remember. But at the same time, I just want to kind of explain that. I'm not racist. I just got bored. And so I stopped paying attention to who was who and what was happening about 15 to 20 minutes into this movie. So
you're just like, there are 13 of them.
Exactly.
They're all going to be fighting.
Actually, no.
Well, 13 was too big of a number, in my opinion, because you really could only associate with so many of them. And so in the final battle, I knew the spear guy because he was the spear guy. I knew the double sword guy because he was the double sword guy. And I knew Shin Zaimon, and I knew the nephew. And the rest were introduced in like 5 minutes early on, and they could have just sat around Shin Zaimon the rest of the time. But I didn't really know who they were, and so I kept having to wait for someone to scream their name when they died. So I go, oh, it was that guy.
You know, by the way, who I was upset with was the 13th assassin. I really liked him, and
mm-hmm.
I hope that he did more than he actually did.
Well, I kind of view him, and I know this might sound like blasphemy to you, Ryan, I kind of view him as the Mifune character of the group. Like, not necessarily in acting chops
yeah.
or in character set position, but in the fact that he was the guy who wasn't necessarily the obvious part of the group and became one of the most inspiring parts by the end of the film.
When he first was introduced, I actually got kind of excited because I thought he would be a really interesting character. And like all the other characters, they just didn't spend any time on them. One of the things, and I know I hate to bring up the analogy because everyone makes it, but with Seven Samurai, they spent a lot of time on the setup and the characters. So when the final battle came along, there was that emotional attachment. I know you're not as big on Seven Samurai as I am, Andrew, but to the characters, for me at least. In this film, I didn't feel it to anyone. Even the characters I thought were vaguely interesting were just... when they died, it was kind of like a... kind of figured that.
When it comes to the characters and your emotional attachment to them versus Seven Samurai versus this film, I feel like Seven Samurai did a lot more work in trying to make you cheer for the fact that they would survive, asking for the film to let your characters survive at the end of this battle. While with 13 Assassins, I feel like you walked in knowing how the battle was going to end, and you were okay with how it was going to end with your characters, especially given the grand scale of the battle. I mean,
and they do make a point of keep alluding to the fact that they're going to sacrifice their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give away too much.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of a fair point about the ending, is that you really go into the ending, in my opinion, solely for the action.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that as visually exciting as the action is, if Miki would have taken a little bit more time and molded out some attributes for some of the characters, then I would have been at the edge of my chair, sweaty palms, just, you know, oh my god, not him, instead of, aww.
Now we have another character to look forward to now. But you see, here lies the difference. I actually felt a connection with a lot of these characters, and I don't know whether this is to the point that I actually rewatched the film today, so I've seen it twice before at this point. I've seen it pretty much twice. Because I watched it today again, and I'm repeating myself because I'm drinking too much beer.
Okay, but anyway, I just like to pose a theory, a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you felt a connection to these characters only because you decided to like this movie before you watched it.
That could be. Could be a good theory. However, I'm going to ignore you and continue. Like, rewatching this movie after seeing it, after going through the action spectacularness that the last hour of this film is, kind of being able to attach a character to each death and each action scene, and understanding a little bit more about each character, I feel that Miki definitely has the character creation that we want from films. We want films to make us cheer for characters, to make us want them to live at the end of the film. We don't want them to be cannon fodder, or in this film it would be samurai sword fodder, I guess, and arrow fodder and stuff, but whatever.
Cow fodder,
definitely. But I feel that this is a film that you really can't take in entirely in one viewing. And you definitely have to sit down and pay attention to all the threads that they're creating. While in your first viewing, you're definitely spending a lot more time paying attention to, like, the bad guy, I've already forgotten his name. Naritsugu.
It sounded like you were going to call him a nuts.
We'll just call him Narnar. How about that?
Narnar. And pretty much the leader of the assassin group, Shinzaemon. But if you actually sit down and you pay attention to a lot of the character traits that they're creating for a lot of these characters, like Hirayama... I hope I'm not butchering their names. Hirayama and Ogucha and
Hanbei.
Well, Hanbei, he's a part of
he's a part of the Akashi tribe.
And he definitely has a little bit of character development in him. And even Koyato, which is the 13th assassin, which you're talking about,
he's number 13.
They're really great. Really great characters, and I really did cheer for them coming through this second viewing.
But they're a handful of the larger group, and there's a lot of them there. You spent a lot of time, was it Hiyoki, Hiyaki, Huki? I don't remember. I really don't. Outside the main four or five, I really don't remember their names. There was like an Iguchi, and a. There was another one that had the name, like being with an M. But I think one of the problems I had with the characters, in terms of just the way they were set up, is you spend time with Shinzaemon, and he's more of a presence than he is really a character. His nephew is a character. Hanbei is a character. The evil lord of super evilness, is a character. But Shinzaemon just kind of shows up and he basically exists to disagree with Hanbei and to make one plan. But if you watch the final battle, or when I watch the final battle, it seemed to me that he disappeared for long periods of time. Like, they would show him running and then it would be a bunch of people dying. And then he would show up running again and fighting a little bit. And then a bunch of people dying. And then it would come back and they would have a final battle. And so I really didn't... I thought he was intriguing because he had a really cool sort of presence, but he didn't really... I don't know. The whole time I just kept waiting for someone, one of the characters, to make me care about them. And I know that's not exactly a great thing because you have to kind of give and take, but... I just felt like I know what they were all going to say before they said it. And when that happens, I think you don't really feel as if there's any drive for you to invest in them. And I don't even know what to do with it. Was it Kyoga? The hunter?
The hunter? Guy? That was... Hey, okay.
The 13th assassin.
Koyata,
man, I was way off.
But well, he's looking for Izupashi.
Exactly. I mean, he shows up, he's kind of goofy for about 15 minutes. And in the battle, he does all these crazy things, and no spoilers, but in the end, you end up looking at him going, they really missed an opportunity to make him incredibly interesting.
Mika's attempt to make the Mifune character from Seven Samurai.
He did, but at the end, he throws a really crazy twist into the character.
Yep, I hear you.
Entirely out of left field, and I went online and read some stuff, and I sort of made the association in backwards, but I was thinking, you know, he could have done a lot with that character that would have made me wet myself wanting to see him during the action scenes. But he doesn't become interesting until after the film's over.
I'm actually surprised at how polarizing this film is. I didn't expect it to be like that.
I don't think it's very polarizing. I just think that me and Ryan are right and you're wrong.
That sounds like polar opposites to me.
See, the thing is, I don't want to sound like I'm too badgering the movie as I am, but it's just one of those situations where I think not so much Mika failed to meet my expectations. It's just that at every interval, while I felt like there was something Miki could have done to make me really invest into it, he just came up a little short. At each little, except for the action. He far exceeded what I could have ever wanted in terms of action. But in all the other components, I just felt like he was flirting with quality and never quite getting there.
Ryan, I invited you on this episode so you could defend me. But now you're just against me, and I'm feeling sad and disappointed.
Well,
if you need defense, I mean, it's fine. I can supply a lot of evidence for... I think this movie, if you go in expecting the kind of movie it is, which is mediocre on character, high on action towards the end, and a lot of caricatures wrapped in kind of a basic... Shogun view, an anti-Shogun view, then you're alright. But I think there's other movies that have taken the Shogun era and done a lot better with it. I mean, Twilight Samurai comes to mind, When the Last Sword Was Drawn, that's sort of the end of the Shogun era that maybe they don't deal with it quite as overtly, but the best way I could describe this movie, it was a movie flirting with greatness that used bad pickup lines. Can't really think of a better way to describe it.
I think I'm just going to drink my beer now.
I'm sorry for keeping hounding you and being and interrupting you.
Speaking of drinking beer, do we have a discussion so I can drink some more?
I don't have anything on hand, but we can come up with something if we want.
And what would that be if we want?
Well, I've been flirting with this black and white discussion for a long while.
What, in terms of which movie is better, color or black and white?
No. Not necessarily which movie is better in color, black and white, but...
By the way, have we all said what we want to say on this movie? I feel like we've
I think we said so much,
and I've definitely zoned out on all of you guys, both of you guys, for quite some time.
Thanks for the alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're basically clear that you're purely negative, other than the fact that you got an action sequence, which I'm not sure if you really enjoyed it at all.
The thing about the action sequence is, no, to tell you the truth, I guess you're good in picking it up, but also I'm probably very blatant, and I didn't really enjoy it that much. But I think I didn't really enjoy it because I didn't understand what kind of movie it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because you kind of hyped me up, you and Damien hyped me up in terms of...
Mike.
Exactly, and how, oh, it's going to be completely action-packed. And then for the... After like 10 minutes, I realized, wait a minute, I don't think these guys are right.
I love
don't ever watch
movie.
Samurai Rebellion, then.
No. You see, well, I don't know. I don't want to say that I... I think I appreciate good movies, and this movie just wasn't that great. And that's probably why I didn't like it. But at the same time, it didn't help that I was expecting a different type of movie.
Like, I'm just happy for Ryan to keep mentioning names, because I'm just writing them down and going, like, I'm going to watch that movie next week. Like, Samurai Rebellion? Holy shit, another Toshiro Mifune film I haven't seen. I'm going to watch that.
You can go through the 60s of Mifune, and it's...
Huh?
I watched one a couple weeks ago called Samurai Assassin, which is not all that different from this movie, though it's based... It's kind of a Shakespearean tragedy wrapped in a historical event. With Mifune as the main character, and I cannot... It's from the same guy who did Sword of Doom, and I cannot remember his name.
Whatever. Once you tell me Mifune is in a movie,
ever.
I must watch it. Mifune is a fantastic. And you start watching
Mifune. Hell in the Pacific with Lee Marvin and Mifune? Is that it? Hell in the Pacific, I think?
I don't think I've seen that one. But we're talking
it's
about...
It's a cool movie, even though it's a horrible, horrible, horrible ending.
We're talking about final thoughts. You know, Douglas has mentioned his. I'm pretty positive on the film. Like, I feel like if you really pay attention, you can get the character threads and then eventually get to the action sequence, which is fantastic.
Eventually.
Yes, thank you for making it sound horrible the way I put it. Ryan, he's mixed. Like, if I'm right, you kind of enjoy bits, and you kind of find other bits which you're like, I've seen it better in other films I've seen.
I think that's a good way of summarizing it. I naturally have a bit of a high expectation for Miki anyways, so I'm trying to, it's kind of for me, because I'm trying to counter that I didn't hate it, but what I didn't like about it stands out so much more to me. Because I keep thinking back on it. It's like, oh, why couldn't you have just done this? Or why couldn't you have just done that? And I would have really liked this. I think, so I don't hate it. I just, since I apparently killed one of you.
So yeah, I think we've said pretty much what we want to say about 13 Assassins. We're pretty mixed on the whole bunch. So I think right now we can say, if you're at all interested in the film, I really suggest renting it and checking it out for yourself. I think that's the best way to put it.
No, don't check it out for yourself. Accept our word as doctrine. We are gods.
I'd just like to take this moment to thank you all for listening to the Unnamed Movie Podcast. Ryan, you can find him, as I mentioned, at univarn.blogspot.com, and you can find him on Twitter at univarn. I am on Twitter at gmanreviews. You can find the podcast on gmanreviews.com. as well as on iTunes and the Podcast Alley. Douglas is DJ I Lost His Name on Twitter. And you can find Douglas and I on Google Plus, because you need to be on Google Plus. If you need an invite, send me an email. I'm andrew.robinson@gmanreviews.com. I'm sure by the time this podcast has been released, Ryan will be on Google Plus, and I don't know if he wants you to find him or not, but you should find him. He's a.
I will be under the pseudonym Bob.
So I just want to take this moment to thank you for listening, and I hope you tune in again. Good night, and remember, always keep your Kurosawa close.
That's a very anticlimactic final line.
Love me. It's not for me to say you'll always care. Oh, but here for the moment I can hold you fast and press your lips to mine. Dream that love will last as far as I can see.
So, in a post-Kurosawa world in which... Douglas is just laughing at me. Can you let me say this without laughing?
Well, no, the thing is, right? So, you say that in a post-Kurosawa world, and it sounds regular, right? But then when you think of the trailer voice...
I'm thinking the exact same thing.
In a post-Kurosawa world.
In a post-Kurosawa world.
It's just like Paper Man. You remember that, right?
Yeah.